This is Value After Hours. Just make sure we're actually live.
I think we are.
It still says I'm setting it live. All right. This is Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlisle, joined as always by Jake Taylor. Special guest today. We've got a four square. Is it markets in turmoil? No, we're talking real estate with Rhett Bennett, Moses Kagan, about Reseed Partners. What's up, fellas? How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure. This is a stock market value investing podcast. So we're doing something a little bit different today with the real estate. You got to explain to us a little bit about what you do.
What is real estate?
Yeah, what is property?
You tell us.
I have no idea.
So let me maybe I'll start out and talk about myself a little bit as I'm, prone to do. and then maybe Rhett can give a little background. We'll talk about Reseed and what we're doing there.
Please.
Moses Kagan, I'm on Twitter all the time. So people who are on there probably have run across me, have been buying, renovating and managing apartment buildings in Los Angeles since 2008. Currently own, depending on what you think of values, roughly like $200 million worth of apartment buildings, all in Los Angeles. We also manage another, call it $300 million worth of buildings for other people on a property manage. So we manage 1,000 apartments and have an internal team and everything. Pretty inactive over the last couple of years, as we will talk about, I'm sure, on this episode. And have launched Reseed with Rhett in part to kind of address that.
And Rhett, where are you based?
I'm based in Boulder, Colorado.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background, your expertise?
Yeah, so I've been an investor in both public and private markets for a little over 20 years. I went to school up in Providence, Rhode Island at Brown, and have recently, with Moses and a couple other partners, started Reseed Partners, which is, our goal is to provide capital to emerging operating partners, both operating capital as well as capital to go. Right now, I'm largely focused on multifamily assets. So go buy multifamily assets across the U.S. at this point.
Moses, you had one of the more popular podcasts that when I was doing the interview format podcast, and part of it was that you have an unusual business model, I think, for the real estate industry. Do you want to just talk us through that? And then we'll talk about how you're working with Reseed.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess maybe to differentiate the way that we've done it and the way that Reseed's doing it from the way most people do it, let me talk first about how most people do it. So the normal real estate private equity model is kind of an IRR driven fix and flip model. So it's buy things that you can quickly lipstick, use as much debt as you possibly can, kind of do a rip and run type renovation, raise the rents, and then immediately sell it on. And all of that is driven by the economic structure of the deals, and crucially by the fact that, at least at an institutional level, the LPs, the capital partners, are not paying taxes, their pension funds and endowments. And so for them, like, maximizing IRR absolutely makes sense. What's weird is that business model has sort of propagated down through the sub-institutional market, where the capital providers are just like normal rich people in family offices who do pay taxes. And so operating as if taxes don't exist is like really crazy. And I can't say that I sort of had that insight when I first started doing real estate deals. We basically bought and renovated a bunch of apartment buildings, sold them, and then I had the like very unfortunate experience of like looking at the tax returns that we had to file in the year that we sold them.
Hold on a second.
Yeah, I'd be like, what the F did we just do? And so that and a couple of other considerations led us to a model where we think more in terms of like indefinite or permanent hold investing, where we buy stuff in good locations, in supply constrained areas. We gut renovate the buildings to make them really nice, rent them out to tenants who we've selected, who are, in general, pretty high quality people, manage them ourselves, distribute the capital, and then refinance to pull out some or all the capital you invested, and then just distribute operating free cash flow as that appears each quarter. So very, in some ways, a very simple model. It's actually like what just like rich families have done for a really long time. But it surprisingly, at least, is like fairly revolutionary for sort of private real estate operators.
Why is it typically done? I mean, high net worth individual people who do real estate development, for the most part, they want their capital back. Is that the reason for doing it the first way? You try to get everything back in one go and then parlay it into a bigger
deal? I think most, like, look, the point of real estate, or at least the point of good real estate, is that it's like the cash flows are very durable, like, and they tend to compound, and they tend to compound faster than inflation if you're in areas that have a lot of demand and have significant supply constraints. So it's like in almost every town, there's like these families that just like buy stuff and then save up some money and then buy more stuff and then save up some money and buy more stuff. And it many of them, like, if you ask them what IRR was or something, they would have no idea what you're talking about. It's just like, that's not how they operate. They're just thinking about buying good stuff and stewarding it well, and that's it. And compounding and buying more. And people have done extremely well doing that for centuries. So this is not like a revolutionary thing at all. It's just that what's unusual about it is that the economics of the GP LP model, the real estate private equity structure, are such that typically the GP can't get paid. The GP, me, the operator, can't get paid until he or she like sells and therefore crystallizes the return and gets to take the money. So there's this weird incentive for the GP to always sell, even when it doesn't really make sense from the LP's perspective.
What's the length of life on a typical LP? Private equity real estate?
Yeah, I mean, the docs are typically struck for 10 years, but like the definitely the goal, and particularly over the last, you know, whatever it's been, 5 or 8 years, has been like, let's get in and out of this thing as quickly as we can, 3 years, something like that. And it's like,
is that right?
Yeah. And so it's when the result is, if you like sort of step back, so that's the economics on like a deal, on an individual deal basis. But the result of that, if you step back and look at like the broader real estate market, has been this like game of hot potato. Mm-hmm. You know, people are just passing these things back and forth.
Marking it up, moving on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a little superficial, we're going to, you know, put in new backsplashes and paint an accent wall and spruce up the leasing office and raise rents by $200 and sell it on to the next guy. And that assets just ping ponging back and forth. And obviously that model has sort of, it was great for the GPs while it lasted, but the music has kind of stopped, and people are now reckoning with the fact that they own assets that are, you know, depreciating in areas that you wouldn't want to own things long-term, et cetera.
So with Reseed, you're hoping to take the same model and then apply it in different markets. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to maybe Rhett should jump in here. But yeah, take what we've learned about how to operate in Los Angeles and apply it in other markets that are interesting.
Yeah, and so maybe a little bit of background would be helpful. I, in my last role, we were trying to build a big real estate portfolio, and we had realized that the sub-institutional real multifamily space is a place you could generate interesting returns in markets like Moses operates. And so I got to know Moses, I guess we first met kind of 4 years ago, and I went to him and I said, we want to deploy a lot of capital in your strategy. I mean, the way that he thinks about unlevered yield on costs and kind of the core of real estate really resonated with me in the way that I think about it. So we were trying to deploy significant capital, and Moses just said, look, I don't need the capital, and B, it's very capacity constrained. And so we took a step back and said, okay, how can we take advantage of what we love about his strategy and be able to kind of increase the total amount of capital that we could deploy? And Reseed is really a result of those conversations. So we're, in a lot of ways, we're trying to take the adaptive model and then take it to a bunch of different cities across the U.S. And the way that we do that is that we have and a lot of this is through Moses Brand, we've recruited like-minded investors. They have come onto the Reseed platform. We provided some initial capital to them. And then we, you know, provide some mentorship and services. And then as they find deals, we'll help them capitalize those assets.
Are you looking for experienced operators, or are you looking for people who are getting started out?
I would say a lot of them are mid-career. So we launched our first cohort in August. And, you know, if you look at the profile, they're kind of mid-30s. Oftentimes they, or if you look at kind of the resumes, they came out of maybe a debt private equity business, or they came out of an institutional real estate JV business. And then in a couple of cases, we have a little bit more non-traditional backgrounds as well, because we're you know, this is our first fund, and we're trying to figure out exactly what the optimal profile for those operating partners will be going forward.
And I, to be honest, when we launched the business, I was expecting to have more like beginners, let's call them. And we were flooded with applications. We can talk about why that is. And so we were, I think pleasantly surprised by the caliber of people who were interested in doing this with us. And I think to a large extent that derives from the following, like people have had now the experience of doing that hot potato business model. And it is actually quite challenging to build an enduring firm based on that model. And the reason is pretty simple. Like you're dependent on crystallizing these promotes, selling, constantly buying and selling, right? And so your revenue into the operating company is unpredictable. It's lumpy, right? And so how do you staff a business like that? Like you can't depend on your AUM like being like a slow upward climb. It's like sometimes you have a lot of stuff, then you sell, you buy, and honestly, like it's pretty stressful to have a bunch of payroll where you don't have offsetting recurring fees to cut or passive income to cover it. You're literally hoping that the promote is there. So you're spending and you're hoping that out of your savings and hoping that you'll be able to sell and realize a promote or whatever. And that's all fine. But it forces you to keep doing deals even when maybe you probably shouldn't do the deals.
That adverse selection issue where just like an underwriter, an insurance company, if they've got nothing better to do and they think they're going to get laid off if they're not bringing float in, then they write stupid risk.
Yeah, exactly. And it's this very weird situation where you're trying, like the whole business exists because the LPs trust you to invest their capital, right? And you've got this like really screwed up incentive structure where you're doing stuff because you got to pay your analysts and your asset managers. And it's just it's a crazy model. And I think a lot of people having experienced that at other firms are like, hey, we are interested in another way of doing this business.
It seems fragile, and it seems to me that at the end of every business cycle, there's always a whole lot of real estate developers who go bust just at the very beginning. That sort of marks the start of it. Guys who are overlevered, and they're just on that margin, start going bust, and then everything else seems to follow from that.
Yeah, and I think we're starting to see that now. I mean, unfortunately, obviously, people are suffering, but you know, it's a classic start of what we think at least a stress, maybe a distress cycle where you have people that are undercapitalized, probably didn't have the operational experience, and they paid a price that really, you know, looking back on it, just didn't make any sense. And so that's we're starting to see loan sales and assets start to trade below kind of the debt basis, which is something we haven't seen in a long time.
I want to add to that too. It's not just, so the prices paid were not good and the operations were not good, but like fundamentally the assets selected were also not good. Like you can,
other than that though, it was cool.
if you own a 1960s or 1970s apartment complex in Phoenix that has not been repiped, like you are in for a world of pain if you own that. Like you will have leaks. If you actually have to eat that cash flow and like that's the source of your returns, you are not going to like the meal that you're eating, right? But for so long that was sort of obscured because you had just leased it up, you know, do paint it, lease, release it, send along to the next guy before the repairs and maintenance really started to hurt you. And now it's just not the, now people are having to eat it.
Must be good though, if you've got a full cycle view and you can see as some of the weaker hands get shaken out, then clearly they're going to be some better prices at some point through this. And anybody who's liquid will be able to make some good deals.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of our thesis. I mean, you know, we started this firm March 1st, and we raised a evergreen vehicle to take advantage of some of what you've talked about, and then we also have additional investors as well. And we haven't actually purchased an asset in this entity. Obviously, Moses and I have purchased a lot of real estate through the years, but when we were first thinking about this, you know, I had real anxiety about, you know, was this the right time? And so we were going pretty slow. And then all of a sudden you've started to see, you know, the signs of stress. And so now the anxiety flipped from, okay, are we going too slow? I mean, are we going slow enough to like, oh, we really need to get the infrastructure in place, because you never know if it's going to be, you know, the opportunity of a lifetime. But it's very clear there's enough stress in the market that you should be able to find good assets that you want to own for a very long period of time.
It's certainly a better buying environment than it has been over the last couple of years. I mean, I haven't bought one of those rehab deals in probably 2.5 years. And we bought some core stuff because we could lock in really long-term, very cheap debt, like prior to the rates sort of spiking. But yeah, we've been really bored around here and inactive because the numbers just didn't make sense. And we're starting to see stuff where you're like, that actually might be interesting.
How do you know when to pull the trigger?
It's a really interesting question. Rhett, do you want to, we've done a whole exercise in creating these buy boxes for each of the operators in different markets. Maybe Rhett, you want to talk about the process we used?
Yeah, exactly. So, we think a lot about unlevered yield on cost, and we have kind of, you know, minimum thresholds that we want to hit.
Maybe explain that though, for people who are,
go ahead.
Yeah. So it's just like super, super simple. And this is like how I was trained to think about real estate really by my first investor. Unlevered yield on cost is very simply annual rent minus annual operating expenses. So net operating income, like effectively like the cash the thing produces, divided by the cost to buy and renovate the property plus any fees. So ignoring mortgage, like no leverage, just thinking about this, like all cash, you put in a certain number of dollars to buy and renovate the asset, and what can you expect on an annual basis in terms of cash flow? So super simple. It's akin to a cap rate, if people are familiar with that. But the reason we talk about unlevered yield on cost is because you can buy a cap rate. A cap rate is like a core deal that's already renovated, stabilized. You buy that, and that's your unlevered yield on cost you have to make. You're buying a shitty building and turning it into something. And so that's hence the unlevered yield on cost. Anyway, sorry, Rhett, for interrupting you, but I just give people some.
No, that's great. Moses has written quite a bit about unlevered yield on cost, so he is the expert. So we started with this notion of we want to have minimum unlevered yield on cost by market. But much like I know you invest in the public markets, like you may pay one price for MasterCard, but you're certainly not going to pay the same multiple for, you know, a company that doesn't have that competitive positioning. And so we then will adjust that unlevered yield on cost based on what we think is the quality of the market. So a lot of that comes down to what's the long-term demand, but more importantly, what's the long-term supply picture. And you can see places like, you know, LA or San Diego tend not to have the same supply response as places like Dallas or Nashville or Charlotte. And so we will require a higher level of unlevered yield on cost when we're going to the markets that are less supply constrained. It is important to know that in those markets, we're looking for micro markets. Like in Dallas, believe it or not, there are markets that are supply constrained. So we still are looking for supply constraints. And, you know, you ask the question, like, how do you know when to buy? At the end of the day, we're not trying to pick a bottom. What we're trying to do is buy great assets that we can own for a very long period of time that hit our return targets where we think that we've conservatively underwritten the asset. And so we will obviously pay attention to what's happening in the macro environment, but at the end of the day, the math on the page will drive our decision-making at the asset level.
And crucially for people who are used to looking at real estate deals, when Rhett says return requirements, it's not what is the IRR here. In other words, there is no like, oh, what are we going to exit this thing at in 5 years? Because like, as all of us know, it's just complete nonsense. I mean, what were you, all these people who underwrote an exit 3 years ago and have now run into the rate buzzsaw. I mean, it's foolish. So what we want to do is own good stuff at a yield that we can tolerate. And then we'll put some leverage on there to the extent that that makes sense. And then the idea is just to hold it. And, we could imagine selling stuff. I mean, we're not crazy. There are things that would cause us to sell assets, but the default is, assuming we picked a good building and it's operating well, like just, distribute the cash and that's it. Periodically refinance it as appropriate and just own it.
I mean, to give a little shout out, we always have folks let us know where they're coming in from. And then let's talk a little bit about the peculiarities of the LA market and the other markets where you're looking at and why they're attractive. Chapel Hill, what's up? Brandon, Mississippi, Cupertino, Toronto. Lewis, Delaware. Thanks, Matt. Spell it out for me. Let me know how to say it. Mendocino, what's up? Scotland, Cincinnati, Alabama, Vestavia, Roll Tide, Kirchheim, Germany, Nashville, Tennessee. What's up? Petah Tikva, Israel. Good for you. Stay safe out there. Deadwood, South Dakota, London, UK, San Antonio, Texas. That's what's me. Good? Madison, Dubai, Auckland, New Zealand. Are you up early? London Town. Yeah, there's Jay. You're with JT. JT's in old London Town right now. Toronto, Miami, Durham, Quebec, Santo Domingo, Copenhagen, Iceland.
All right, that's enough.
Czech Republic, New York. There we go. Good spread.
Unreal. It's so, what an amazing world we live in.
That's fun, so isn't bizarre, it? Isn't it?
That's why so I read it. I think it's so much fun.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, LA, you said, LA has this supply constraint. Is that because it's a big bowl or is that a regulation issue?
It's mostly a regulation issue. There's some geographic constraints in the sense that we have an ocean, obviously the Pacific to the west that sort of stops.
Keep going.
But it sprawls very far. I'm kind of doing the directions background for you, but it sprawls very far to the east. But fundamentally what's gone on is that LA used to be zoned for, I think, a capacity of 10 million people. This is back in like the 50s. And the homeowners basically just came in and were like, okay, that's enough of that. and downzoned the whole city in like the 60s and 70s to a 4 million population capacity. And to give you a sense for what that means in real life, we own a building that we bought and renovated. I think we probably bought it like 4 years ago, where it is, I think it's a 7-unit apartment building and it's surrounded by single family homes. And it is literally illegal to build any more apartment buildings around there. It's R1 zoning. So it was this building was the first one built before the neighborhood was downzoned in the 60s. And then they downzoned it and it literally, they would put you in jail if you built another apartment building in the surrounding blocks around our building. Like, it's pretty difficult to think of a better moat than we will put your competitors in jail if they try, right?
Yeah, almost literally a moat.
Yeah. Right. And so it's like, you know, not everything we own is, of course, like that, but just an enormous number of the buildings are. And then there are some other factors that we can get into that constrain supply, but zoning in all of its sort of various and arguably nefarious forms is really at the heart of it.
Because I follow you on Twitter, so I see the stuff that you put out about the regulatory environment in Los Angeles is just mind boggling. Makes no sense.
Well, it's like it's so bad that it's like there, if you want to assume good faith, then you have to assume like deep incompetence. Or if you're willing to accept that it might be bad faith, then you're like, oh, this is very devious. You know, but it's some combination of those factors.
There's nothing flattering that you could take away from it, though.
Well, it's certainly just not. The whole thing is designed to retard supply growth. And every time the YIMBYs, the Yes in My Backyard crew, like attack some constraint, some other crazy one bubbles up over here. You know, it's like we're not going to have park, you know, we're not going to have minimum parking requirements anymore. Oh, low impact development. Like you need to make sure that there's no stormwater runoff, or you need to put solar panels on your single family home. Or it's just, and it's all of those things obviously sound great in isolation, but the effect is obviously just to drive the price up and therefore on the margin to make a bunch of projects infeasible that otherwise would have been. So it's just like this never-ending game of creating these increasingly devious supply constraints.
But if you're a developer, then that's an advantage too. So is that what you look for, supply constraints in other markets?
Yeah, maybe Rhett can chime in about like what, you know, what kind of things we're looking for. But yeah, you don't basically the what you don't want to be is the guy with a building next to a bunch of other buildings that are in the process of opening. And with a bunch of land people can build, because people will just keep building. To the extent that rents go up, people will build more buildings, and those people will need to fill those buildings. So they'll offer concessions to fill their, and you as the one who owns the like now slightly aging building that is trying to compete with the brand new ones, right, will never get to really push your rents because the guy next door is always offering some move-in discount basically.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the unique features about real estate is that your moat or competitive positioning isn't nearly as tied to size as it is in public markets, right? Like oftentimes the most dominant players in the public markets, you know, there's a correlation between quality and scale. And that is not necessarily true in real estate. And so some of these micro markets where you can buy smaller assets that are very well located in environments where, you know, as Moses used the term YIMBY, but NIMBY, right? The opposite of that is, you know, in some ways, if you own an asset, you want to be in markets that are characterized, you know, as being, you know, NIMBY, because the probability that you have pricing power is much higher if you don't have, you know, competing product showing up next door.
Yeah, let me give you an example. Probably the hottest rental neighborhood in Los Angeles over the last, call it 5 or 10 years, has been Highland Park, which is this cool neighborhood in Northeast LA. It's like walkably urban. You know, there's a metro that takes you into downtown and it's super cool. And there were a bunch of apartment buildings built there in the 80s and early 90s, right? There was sort of a boom. A bunch of these buildings got built, but the neighborhood is mostly characterized by single family and like very like duplex apartment buildings that were built kind of in like the teens and 20s. So in the 90s, when the neighborhood got really pissed that these buildings were being ripped down or replaced by apartment buildings, they just put a historic preservation zone on. So it's like, doesn't even matter what the underlying zoning is. You're literally not allowed to rip down these dilapidated single family homes and duplexes to build any more apartment buildings. So imagine what an amazing thing that is to own. And those 80s and 90s buildings are non-rent control. Like, so you can, in other words, you can raise the rent pretty much, you know, with the market. And people are desperate to be in the neighborhood, and literally it's illegal to build any more supply. It's just like, I mean, it's a license to print money, honestly, from the landlord's perspective.
Have you guys followed, I don't know if it's a little bit outside. It's not what you guys are doing, but I see them come through Twitter, these office buildings in San Francisco, I think mostly, but other places as well, where it seems like 2015, they'd sell for like $200 million. And 2023, they go for like 65 or something like that. Is that what's going on? Numbers.
I mean, look, there's a number of things going on there. I mean, one is the obviously work from home and the pandemic. The other thing is, I think more fundamentally, the office business has for a long time not really been a cash flow business. It's always been a trading business. because it's not every time a new tenant moves in, they demand that you spend an enormous amount of money on TIs, on tenant improvements, to make the space beautiful for them. And then you have to pay their broker these huge amounts of money. And insanely, and this is, I didn't understand this until like maybe 2 years ago when I looked at it and I almost fell out of my desk chair. They don't, when they're thinking about the NOI, which is the net operating income that they apply a cap rate to price the buildings, they do not take into account those tenant improvements and the leasing commissions. They're like, it's below the line, like not important. So like
adjusted EBITDA.
It's So you're like, everyone's trading. Oh, I bought an office building that's a 5K. It's like, no, you didn't. There's no cash flow coming off this thing at all. And basically, so now that we're in a market where people are like demanding actual cash yield, there is not. I mean, there's a price where there's cash yield, but as we're seeing, it is way lower than what we were paying. And so there's just like a massive reckoning going on there.
Yeah, one thing that's going to be, as you said, it's not our area, but one thing that's going to be fascinating to watch is that obviously people are resetting their basis. And a big part of your operating costs is the tax base and those assets. And now that you're, you know, obviously buying it much lower than maybe your competitor in 2015, it will, there's going to be people that can run buildings at very different economics in terms of top line rent than we've seen in years past. So that's not our business, but people that are stepping in now, it's probably going to be a really interesting, you know, return generator over the next 5-10 years.
I wasn't sure. I just thought it looked like they were trophy assets, and then you just something new comes along, and it's where you were once the nicest premium price. As a result, now you're third tier or fourth tier, and you're just getting absolutely hosed.
And this part of it will be familiar to your sort of public equities investors. A big part of what was going on in the office business was these assets are so large. Just like the amount of capital required to buy them is so large that it's like a very efficient business to be in for capital allocators. Like you can, there's not that many assets that can soak up $100 million equity check, right? But those big trophy office buildings in San Francisco and LA and New York. So there was this game being played of basically just, however many of these big operators are just trading these assets back and forth. And from the perspective of the institutional capital providers, it was like, great, I have to have my office allocation and I can do write a couple of checks a year and that's it. Like that's my office allocation. It's way harder. And in fact, we're kind of trying to do this with Reseed is if you want to actually build a good portfolio, of smaller assets, there's just a lot more diligence. There's a lot more friction involved in putting a portfolio like that together.
So with Reseed, does it help to have, so your partner does the diligence and you guys are ultimately decide to go or not, or you give them guidelines for what you're looking for? How does that all work?
Yeah, so we definitely start with guidelines, kind of back to our unlevered yield on cost conversation. And then we've got a quality scorecard that helps our partners understand what we look for in terms of the physical asset as well as the market we're in. I would say that we ride shotgun, so we're sitting next to them in the due diligence. Moses and I were on site in an asset, I think a week or two ago, which is probably illustrates the way that we go about it. Like, we have a very clear set of underwriting guidelines of how we look at real estate. And we expect the operating partners to adopt that and incorporate that into the underwriting. And then when they find an asset and we're going to go and, you know, do the diligence, Moses and I and, you know, some of our other partners will be on site. And so we certainly rely on the operators to identify the assets and do the initial underwriting. But our business model requires that we're also doing our own work outside of their process.
The diligence process, in my opinion, is like the heart of one of these platforms. Like, so we have talked about this before, but we have probably a 3-page single spaced, like 8-point font list of all the different ways we've screwed up. And some of those things are, many of those mistakes are applicable across markets. Things like, you know, did you go visit the property at night and are there gangsters hanging out in front of it at night? Right. Like that's applicable across a lot of markets. There's also Los Angeles or California specific issues that we have to deal with. So we have this long, and every time we screw something up, it's rare that we screw something new up because we've just screwed up so much that we've like hit most of the greatest hits. But periodically, we still screw things up. So that gets added to the list. And so what we did is sort of give that list to each of the operators as a starting point. And over time, those lists will evolve in each of their markets to reflect the specific market conditions that they're dealing with. But the expectation is that before they, and by extension, we commit irrevocably to moving forward with any of these deals, that they're literally going to go through that list and like initial next to each of these, like, yes, I have thought about the gangsters. Yes, you name it. Yes, there is, cable TV service can be provided to this building. You're like, yes, I have considered the effect on the views that I value so highly if someone develops across the street, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, the answer is they're responsible, but for the diligence, but like, we're the ones ultimately putting investor money at risk when we capitalize these deals. So like, we have to be there too.
I've got one of those lists too. I'm adding to it all the time. JT, do you want to give us your vegetables, your make glorious learnings, make benefit, whatever it is?
Yes, I do. So this week, I was in the Midwest a couple weeks ago, and I often I'll try to like bring a book to read that's sort of related to that area if I can. And Buffett's mentioned numerous times how he's surprised that more people haven't studied State Farm auto insurance more. He's mentioned this a few times during the annual meetings, and the company ended 2022 with $131 billion of net worth. And so I'll just give you like a quick quote of Buffett talking about State Farm. Next to Berkshire, it's the leader in having net worth. It's a mutual company, but some guy just figured out that there was a cartel running car insurance. A Farmer from Myrna is the name of the book, and he created a system where he took 20 points out or so out of cost. Nobody's owned stock in State Farm. It's an insult to capitalism, actually. Everything you learned at the business school says it shouldn't work because nobody owns it. Nobody's going public with it. So I read the book, and I'll give you some kind of interesting highlights from something that Buffett said we should have done, and probably most of us hasn't. The book was actually written in 1955, and it's a biography about this founder, and his name is George Meherl, but that's spelled Mecherle. He's German, and he was born in Myrna, Illinois, in 1877. To immigrant parents, and he grew up on a farm as a farmer. He was actually quite successful. He was an extroverted guy, and he always liked to talk to other farmers about crop prices and new scientific findings about soil management. Like he lived it, and he effectively retired at age 44, and he was leasing out his farm to these tenant farmers. And to keep busy, he sold tractors for a while, and he discovered that he had a knack for selling to farmers specifically because he was one, and he knew what they needed. And he believed that city insurance companies were getting over on farmers with higher premiums based upon the city driving was just like more accident prone. There are fewer cars out to crash into each other in the countryside. And he became obsessed with this idea of starting his own insurance company. An honest insurance company is what he always called it. And he started this company that was named State Farm the day after his 45th birthday. So I find that actually to be a little bit inspiring. Like, if you're already getting a few on in age as some of us are, gosh, this guy started at 45 and still, it's not quite maybe like, what was the Kentucky Fried Chicken guy when he started?
Colonel Sanders.
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't know, 70s.
Yeah, something like that. So farmers had long formed these mutual like co-ops for fire insurance to share risk. So, by 1890, I think every state in the Midwest had them, and there were these agreements where everyone would pay into a pool. And if someone had the bad luck of a fire, let's say, it would be covered by the group. And there were 216 fire mutuals in Illinois alone in 1921, which is the year before they started State Farm. But no one had ever taken that concept of a mutual and applied it to auto insurance. And autos were making the transition at that time from like toys to actual, you know, necessity of American life. And here's how the economics worked of what State Farm constructed. $15 was paid as a one-time membership fee. $19 were paid for the first 6 months of the premium. And then $1 from each renewal premium went to this private company that was owned by Mehrl. And in fact, actually several years passed before he was ever like even close to sufficiently compensated. Like he had practically worked for free for a long time, but then eventually it proved to be very lucrative for him. But he had an insight of adding a $10 deductible, which, you know, if everybody's done insurance before, they understand what that means. But it was kind of an ingenious solution, because what it did is it kept a lot of these little petty claims from being filed. And also the farmers, you know, they probably had to pay for their own minor repairs, so they probably drove a little bit more carefully. And, you know, Mehrl, this company was able to operate 40% cheaper than stock company competitors because he had actually like figured out a bunch of stuff here. And the first thing is that he had this novel idea of collecting premiums every 6 months instead of annually. And that actually lined up a lot closer with the farmers' kind of cycles of when they would have cash, which was important. And also it allowed them to change rates faster. So, you know, if you're changing rates, if you're too slow to change rates, like that's either you're overcharging and they find someone else, or you're undercharging and you're not getting paid for the risk that you're taking. They centralized billing and collections at the home office in Illinois, which was previously done out in the field by agents. And those agents would get the money and like they'd have it for like 45 to 75 days typically. So they had float on you in a way, which obviously not helpful. And the $15 membership fee didn't require reserves against it like traditional premiums that you would write by regulation. So State Farm could actually grow faster than a lot of the other companies. They found a source of capital basically. And the new members kind of paid for their own acquisition costs effectively with that $15 membership. And they were very careful about who they selected to underwrite. And that allowed them to discriminate a lot of bad underwriting risks. Like they wouldn't cover drunk drivers, they appealed a lot to the moral, like high moral farmers. And this is how a mutual kind of worked. I don't know if you guys have ever seen this before, but you know, that $19 premium deposit, let's say that the share of the cost that year were $10. And so that leaves $9 left over from premiums. There'd be a credit that was created of $9 for the user, for the member. And then they would have to add a fresh $10 to restore the premium deposit. And then it would repeat every renewal period. And the customers actually felt like this really strong loyalty. And they would display the, you know, State Farm insurance medallion on their automobiles. And like people would like brag about it, which kind of hard to imagine nowadays, right? It was also, let's just talk a little bit about like how well this took off. They really caught lightning in a bottle. Started in 1922. After 6 months, they had 1,300 policies in force, and that created $29,000 in revenue, insurance premiums, which is about $500,000 today, adjusted for inflation. 6 years later, they're at 69,000 policies, and that's like a 94% CAGR for 6 years. This is like an early hyperscaler for everybody who likes those kinds of businesses. By 1944, they had over 1 million policies, which is a 35% CAGR for 22 years. And in 1951, when George Mehrl passed away, it was at 2.2 million policies and $119 million in underwriting revenue. And by the time the book was written in 1955, they were at 3.4 million policies. There's wrapping this whole thing up. There's this beautiful Emerson quote that's in the book that really sums up State Farm and George Mehrl. And it's, an institution is the length and shadow of one man. He was the guy for State Farm. Like he was totally the driving force to get it going and turned it into this, you know, this behemoth that, kind of defies the laws of capitalism and, you know, this mutual system.
That's fascinating, JT. Did they tell you what he did on the asset side?
There was a guy who was managing that, and I think it was primarily just in bonds. Like it was pretty generic time period. They weren't that creative.
Safe.
Yeah. There's not a ton of float either in auto insurance because it's such short tail liability, right? Like the money comes in, it typically goes out relatively quickly, and it's only through the growth, the additional policies, that where you add into the float.
You said, and I think it's well known that all of the inflation for the current car insurance is, it's making car insurance tough for Geico and so on.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, there's kind of a little bit of an analog of this they talk about in the book. It is actually World War II. And what happened there was that everybody, well, one, they couldn't find enough workers to like service the business because, you know, you had people off fighting wars. And then everyone came back and they hadn't, and also all the like materials for creating cars were being used to make tanks at that point, right? So there were everyone was like running on threadbare tires because all the rubber had been used for World War II. And everyone was back and like eager to go drive around, right? Like they're back, they survived. And so there were tons of accidents that were driving shitty cars at that point, like crashing into each other. And there was a lot of inflation that was happening post 19 World War II, because I mean, frankly, we ran huge deficits. We printed a bunch of money to fund the war. So they had like huge inflation costs and like way more than normal accidents. And it was like a pretty treacherous time for the business because you ended up with just like kind of a perfect storm for an insurance to have issues. And like COVID might be a little bit of some of the same thing that happened. People are cooped up and then they're eager to get out there. And then you have a bunch of inflation from printing for a war on a germ. And, you know, I think some of the same dynamics take a while to play out.
At least speaking for the, not for cars, but for real estate, the real estate insurance market has gone bananas.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It is. Insurance, I think if you asked multifamily operators across the country what their single biggest issue right now, I guess the biggest issue for some of them would be the, you know, short-term balloon financing. But if you leave the capital stack out of it,
if you can survive that, then
it's the insurance cost. It has gone crazy. I mean, part of it is lots of development in areas like Florida that are disaster prone anyway, but to a large extent, it's the replacement cost, the cost of fixing stuff, it has just skyrocketed as a result of deficits of labor. And then there was all the supply chain issues, and then those have sort of been hammered out, but the Inflation Reduction Act means that there's like a ton of concrete and steel and all that stuff going into government infrastructure or energy infrastructure projects instead of into fixing apartment build or building apartment building. So it is, I mean, construction costs have gone crazy and maybe are softening a little bit. So maybe we'll start to see this trend reverse, but insurance is like, in some markets, insurance has doubled, more than doubled. It's really hurting operators.
Does it help you to have the operating businesses alongside the fund management business? How do they interact with each other?
Well, for us, it for sure. I mean, we're our property management business basically does more than cover the cost of the whole platform at this point. So, we're able to continue to employ like my acquisitions guy and finance capacity and whatever that we would not be able to, because we've been so inactive on the deal side. The other thing is, and probably more importantly, we feed information from the management side into underwriting for new deals. So like I set all the rents in the existing portfolio. I set the renewal prices. I'm seeing the vacancy. I'm seeing the operating expenses. And so all of that data is being fed into how we underwrite new deals. And it can be bad because it's like, sometimes you wish you didn't know the numbers because it would be easier. Right. But you know, we do. And so we're not going to lie to ourselves. And that means, you know, it forces a certain kind of conservatism into the underwriting.
What's happened to rents and vacancy? Is this, they say that it's the most unaffordable housing market ever, or, you know,
rent is
going
too
back
damn
through
high.
The data. Going back through the data to wherever it starts, like 1960 or 1980 or whatever. How does that show up on the ground?
This has been market by market, like, and some markets, you know, the response to COVID was to move a whole bunch of people around the country. So some markets went absolutely crazy. In Phoenix, Austin went nuts. New York and LA were losing people, and particularly in that sort of like prime renter age demographic, people went home. So rents got really soft during COVID. Then we had sort of a delayed boom where It got really hot here like a year or so ago, maybe a bit more, but it has now cooled. I mean, we've kept vacancy under control by reducing rents. Mm. So I think we're probably 2 or 3% vacant at this particular moment. So vacancy very low. Everyone's paying, or almost everyone's paying, but we're cutting face rents for sure to keep.
Yeah, it's very different by market too, and by submarket, because the supply response was largely at the higher end of the quality spectrum. And so if you go to downtown Nashville right now, I mean, it's a great time to be looking for an apartment, because they're given 2 and 3 months free rent in order to fill up, very nice, well-located assets. And as Moses said, there's a lot of markets that you just didn't see that supply response. So I'd say maybe more than ever, the divergence, you're really seeing a divergence among markets and submarkets.
This is, again, a little bit outside your direct kind of area of expertise, but it's property related. But the single family residences seem to have been, that might be the wrong term for it, but there's this meme, or there's this idea that because everything's so unaffordable, and yet there's very few transactions going through because people have got the lower mortgage rates. What do you guys think about that?
I think there's a bunch of fascinating kind of second order effects, right? I mean, you've obviously seen home builders having to buy down rates in order to drive volume. It's a much, much smaller pie, but they're able to take a larger percentage of that pie just because the inventory on the used product is not as available. So that's a fascinating thing. I think, one of the things for me is the build for rent space and the single family rental space. That's actually been stronger than maybe I would have originally thought. And a lot of that has to do with just the population and the demographic that are kind of aging out of wanting to live in a certain type of apartment and want to move up to a single family home. So that, I mean, I think folks focused on that business would say that, they've continued to really kind of enjoy a demand tailwind.
It's been a wild ride in property with, like, lumber's a pretty big input to what you guys do. I'd say lumber went absolutely bananas through COVID.
Lumber went crazy. But I mean, you name it, it was hard in there. I mean, we like a deal that would have taken us 2 years pre-COVID, or a little less than 2 years, because of COVID, those deals took 3 years. Just you name it, it was get the labor that you couldn't source refrigerators because all that stuff was coming from China, and all those supply chains were screwed up. So air conditioners, dishwashers, like the list of things that goes into a new apartment it's really long, and all kinds of stuff that your listeners are not thinking about. Cabinet hardware, the letters the address letters that go on, you name it, it was hard to source the stuff. And I mean, we had to compromise because we have more or less a standard package of stuff that we want to do in most of our units. And at a certain point, it was just like, look, like, yeah, those refrigerators, we can't get the refrigerators we want. So whatever refrigerators you've got, send them over. I mean, we have a longstanding policy of not putting water and ice dispensers, refrigerators with water and ice dispensers into apartments, because it's like with 100% certainty those are going to break. And it's just a pain in the ass to fix them. And they absolutely do not add a single dollar of rent. So it's pure downside from your perspective, just operational complexity and cost for no reason. And lo and behold, I have a bunch of apartments with, water and ice dispensers in there now, because that was the only thing we could buy. I mean, it was crazy. It was the hardest from a construction perspective. It was definitely the hardest operating environment in my career.
Why is it so hard to keep those things running? Yeah. Ours freezes over anytime it gets below 80 degrees in the house.
You name it, like leaks, all that stuff. It's obviously the joke is like, meanwhile, your grandmother's refrigerator from 1965
is still cruising.
The garage is working still. But yeah, like And these ones, you know, they last for 3 years. Then you get it, they break, and then the technician comes. And they're like, "Look, we can repair it, and it'll be 50. It's exactly 50% of the cost of a new one." And you're like, "That's like the life of a property manager is being like, well, should we repair this or not? Or I don't know. It's just never ending."
Did it change anything about the way that you have done business subsequently? What have you sort of learned from it?
Well, it pushed us out of the rehab business. I mean, it just meant that, like, and this is the case, I think, for now, especially, like, when we started doing those rehabs, the length of time that we had to spend with the building vacant wasn't a big deal because there was very low opportunity cost from the investor's perspective. It's like, okay, it's been sitting here for 2 years with no cash flow, but like interest rates are zero, so who cares? Now, if you're going to do a 2-year reno, which is now going to get pushed out by some kind of city bureaucracy or, you know, supply chains or whatever to three years, like there's a major cost in terms of the foregone, even just like sitting in bonds or whatever. So there's now that you have to feel like you're going to move very, very quickly to make rehabs make sense.
What are you most looking forward to over the next few years? Is it a good environment, or is it a, you know, a rougher macro environment, which is a better investing environment? Or how are you thinking about it?
What do you think, Rhett?
I just think I'm most looking forward to a return to, you know, rational underwriting. It some of what Moses described early in the call with the lipstick on a pig, as we call it, renovations. I mean, when we capitalize an asset, we're going to do that very conservatively and oftentimes all cash. And as people became, you know, so focused on IRR and levered IRR, that if you are a person that uses a pretty conservative capital structure, you just become not competitive. And there's all kinds of other places in real estate where people in a lot of ways lie to themselves in terms of what the, you know, actual cash flow of the asset's going to be. Now we should return to an environment, return to an environment where people are actually underwriting more conservatively, which allows us to be more competitive and hopefully buy great assets.
When did you see the divergence? Start happening. When did the divergence start happening between sort of
real craziness? Yeah. The real craziness. I would say things got really nuts in 2020 for me. I mean, it was already starting to feel kind of toppy in like 18 and 19. And then I think this happened in all asset classes, like the COVID money spigot kind of just extended things into like la la land. I mean, and what you could see is, if you looked at cap rates, which again is like the annual rent minus annual expenses divided by the cost of buying the building, so forget about leverage or whatever, their cap rates reflect a number of things. It's like they reflect investors' estimation of both the riskiness of the cash flow. They're embedded like an expectation about growth of rents and therefore of NOI. Like, so there's a number of the investors' expectation about the capital environment, interest rates, et cetera. So there's a number of things going on. But in a healthy real estate market, there is wide divergence in cap rates between different kinds of assets and different markets. Like a really good, a very well-located, well-designed apartment building should trade in a supply-constrained market, should trade at a very different cap rate from some kind of peripheral property with issues on the edge of a tertiary market. And yet what happened, particularly in like 20 and 21, is there was no spread at all between the cap rates for across markets, but also asset classes. It's just like, it's really operationally intensive to run a hotel. Right. And so some tertiary market hotel should absolutely not be trading at the same cap rate as a well-located
storage unit.
Yeah. It's just like, this is just nuts. And so what we're starting, so that was like the signal that things were bonkers, because no one was like, it was all being driven by the availability of cheap debt, which is why the prices all got bid up. And like, people were buying shitty apartment buildings in Phoenix where the rents were already starting to like, you know, starting to wheeze. And it was like, you know, we were getting pitched three caps. like 3% yield on a shitty, and that's with sort of reasonable but not insanely conservative estimates for operating expenses. It was cool. You're gonna a 3 cap for like a shitty old complex and like a bad part of Phoenix. Like, are you crazy? And that was going on all over the country. And unfortunately, a lot of people bought that stuff with, you know, balloon loans and short term bridge debt and all that stuff. And those, you know, obviously that's coming home to roost now.
There was a single, like single family home. Like, what's the single best ROI project that you could do for your house?
For a single family home?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not, outside my circle of competence. I'll tell you, an apartment building.
Okay, that's good. Yeah.
Apartment building, it's landscaping.
Mm. Is it trees? Isn't that what Munger's guy says, is putting trees in?
Yeah, he's right. And I'm going to repeat myself on a tweet, but like, so the entire business of long-term real estate ownership is basically like this war against entropy. It's just breaking, you fix them, they break in. Like, that's what it is, right? Except well-done landscaping compounds in value.
I could see that.
Because, you plant these trees and they get bigger and nicer over time. And I joke with Rhett that, like, you could probably pick the neighborhoods we'd like to own real estate in by, like, looking for where the mature trees are.
Yeah. The sun is doing your work of fighting entropy.
That's right.
Yeah, you get this nice, beautiful. People love trees, and it signals a lot about how the neighborhood is being taken care of, and whatever. And tenants love it, and anyway, so that's in my mind, that's the single best, highest ROI.
I think that's probably conveyed
some survival advantage at some point in our evolution.
Yeah,
that's a good point to end it on. High point to end it on. Gents, if folks want to get in contact with you or follow along with what you're doing, how do they go about doing that?
I think the best way is, obviously, you can follow Moses on Twitter, or you can go to reseedpartners.com. And if you're interested in investing, there's a link on our website.
Rhett Bennett, Moses Kagan, thanks very much, gents.
Thank you.
See you, folks. We'll be back next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. Billy will be back next week.